Gavin also makes that point that it's Hinduism that provides the kind of the unifying structure, and he points out that that's interesting because you can see practices being recognised across different regions, across different language groups in India, across different sects, across really different ethnicities and cultures, and yet a Hindu who goes into a temple in Kerala and in Sri Lanka, and for that matter in Thailand, and in Bengal, and in Assam, and in Uttar Pradesh, and in Ladakh, etc., etc., and in the Caribbean, and in New York, will be able to do more or less the right practices, or at least to understand the grammar of practice, if you want to put it in that way. So that there's that argument that the grammar, it's the, what is the language that unites Hinduism? It's the language of practice and the grammar of practice, and that fits in a way. That notion that practice is providing the language through which people's identities are created, and that's very trendy, partly because often embodied, enacted, and bodily identities are very trendy at the moment. The idea that it's not what you say or think, but actually what you're acting out that defines who you are. That fits very nicely with the idea that practice is the central unifying structure in Hinduism. And that, in turn, fits with the idea that practice in Hinduism is strongly grammatical. So in contrast to religions that have a set ritual you repeat again and again, or religions in which particular symbolisms are telling you how to do the ritual, or religions in which, or religions in which ritual is very spontaneous and open and individual, and you get to do what you want in it. In contrast, Fritz Starlet was one of the first to say Hindu ritual from the Vedic period onwards continues to be highly grammatical, i.e. there are set forms with a kind of a grammar of how they relate to each other that determine all ritual. And there's an interesting article by Axel Michaels on Newar ritual in, I think, Nepal that was in that issue of the Journal of Hindu Studies, where he says, look, this is a regional, a super localized ritual done by people who really don't know any Sanskrit, far away from standard Vedic contexts, but the way in which they're using the grammar of ritual is very similar to the kind of things we can expect to learn from Vedic culture. So what kind of things go behind each other or after each other? What kind of language follows with what kind of action? How the order of action, language, symbolism, and substances all go together. And how, in fact, it's the order and the structure of that ritual that makes it right, so that you can replace blood with vermilion paste, and you can replace milk with butter, and you can replace a mantra in this language with a mantra in that language. But what you mustn't do is replace the order, if you like, the grammar, the structure of those things, because that's what makes it right. And kind of looks at the way in which that grammatical structure actually provides a infinitely variable, infinitely expandable, unifying feature for Hinduism. So no matter what country, no matter what language, no matter what substances you have available to you, no matter what deity you're doing the ritual to, no matter which life stage you're commemorating, no matter for all the variables, still that basic grammatical structure can be applied. And that's something that in some way seems very appealing. And some would see as the kind of structure that is able to unite a culture as diverse as Hinduism. If a creedal structure is never going to get there because creeds deal in things like truth values and there are inner logics to the concept, well, a grammatical action structure is a bit more flexible. So there's a big focus on the way in which that works. But I think one of the things I want to say leading into this is that while Stahl introduces the idea that it's all basically meaningless, right? This is practice, not belief. Keep belief out of it. Therefore, content, symbolic content, creedal content, actual specific reference to conceptual meanings is out of the picture. And of course, Fritz Stahl brings that out in his book on rules without meaning, the idea that Vedic ritual is rules without meaning. And by extension, this is where Hinduism starts to get into theory. Ritual can be rules without meaning, that in fact, human practices can be rules without meaning. Right, that there might be some kinds of things that we do without there being a meaning behind it. And he writes on that. And I think for him, it actually became part of a bigger idea that we need to acknowledge that such things happen. And this is part, I think, this is before we've even gotten to people like Bourdieu and habitus and habits that you do for non-conceptual reasons, as it were. Right? That was really important, partly because it provokes this question. It ties an interesting way into all the debates within Hinduism about whether Hinduism is a fundamentally conceptual religion or whether it's a lifestyle. And of course, it goes into colonialist issues. You know, are they doing meaningless things? Is their practice for no reason? Is it unthinking tradition? Sons doing what their fathers do because authority perpetuates itself, and that leads back into that old debate of whether traditions can get old, whether traditions can get stale. Whether practice without meaning is stale, right? It raises a whole set of interesting questions about the nature of practice in human life in general, and how, if people have religious practices, how they work, particularly when they're inherited. People are much easier, I think, in religious studies in talking about things you do because you've taken them on because they have a meaning, things you do because you've taken them over from a tradition. People have gotten very bad at talking about that as still being meaningful to you. Because the tradition, taking it on because it has a tradition, seems to supplant the idea of taking it on because you value it. Right. So in a way, tradition and meaningfulness get opposed, just as behavior and meaningfulness, in a sense, are being opposed. So I think I just want to kind of maybe question that and say that what's come since then is a number of people who want to say that practice has all kinds of meaning. The problem is that we no longer look at it necessarily as propositional meaning. It's not that when I do this action, it means such and such. You can find that in the Vedas. You can find that in symbolic equivalences and readings, etc., etc., or in notions that we're reliving an event from the past or whatever. But people have actually expanded outwards and said, well, there are other kinds of meaning in action. And there's a whole range of things that you can look at there that tries to do that. And I think there's this idea that behavior and belief are not necessarily separate in Hindu culture, for actions are often the most earnest and holistic expression of underlying beliefs, so that when you do the action, other things are coming to play. Whether that's not so much a propositional thing, when I do this ritual, this will happen. It means this, it does this, and this will happen. But it may, for instance, be part of an underlying worldview. I do this because the action implicitly reinforces ritta or dharma, and that implies a view of the world as a structured view, a structured world in which human actions have efficacy to reinforce underlying structures. And so then the ritual doesn't have a propositional content to it, but it is actually given its meaning by the assumption of a world picture, which actually is really complex and really interesting, and has implicit in it a whole theory of what action does and how it affects the world. And beyond that, people have also suggested it can show you the underlying beliefs without itself having an explicit meaning or symbolism to it. Laurie Patton has emphasized the way in which Vedic rituals work in connection with texts to evoke a powerful ethos and interpretation of the world. So her book, what was it, Bringing the Gods to Mind, Ritual and Mantra in Vedic Thought, where she has this notion that the actions are linked to mantras, which are linked to visualization or just imagination and an ethos that evokes a certain experience of the world that itself ties into a worldview. To me, it's very Clifford Geertzian in a way. You've got symbols that evoke moods and motivations that tie into a certain ethos that itself assumes a certain worldview. And that many-leveled structure of the meaning of an action is maybe what we need to see what's going on in these rules without meaning, rather than looking for one-to-one symbolic correspondences. So as people like Laurie Patton's work has been helpful, Gavin Flood has demonstrated the way in which tantric rituals create an embodied experience of tantric beliefs about the self, the world, and the divine. So that for Gavin, it's not just that doing the ritual links you to a poetic picture of the world. You're making that world into your reality by imposing it, what's the right word? I mean, he'd say entextualizing yourself, you know, or instantiating it, or enacting that world so that it becomes part of your own physical reality. You're not just acting in it, you're acting in part of it. You yourself become embedded within the underlying assumptions of that world. And for Gavin, that's textualizing yourself. But text here, of course, doesn't mean just the text. It means the whole worldview expressed by the text. I would probably call it enworlding myself or something like that. It's not just textualizing, but putting yourself into a certain world. And David Gordon White, for me, has been really helpful in bringing out this hermeneutic key idea. There are so many practices that seem odd and were therefore ignored. Practices to do with possession, practices to do with substances, metals, planets, the ways in which demons, planets, substances, metals get combined with a certain model of the human body. How do demonology and possession and alchemy come together? All of that stuff, to a large extent, was ignored until David Gordon White started to show this is the assumed world. Right? And until you get that assumed world, and for him, alchemy was actually the key. Substances that can transform their natures, and a nature is not just a different state of something, it's actually a spirit in some sense. Once he started to bring that out in books like The Alchemical Body, and the Sinister Yogis to some extent as well, people start to see connections that they couldn't see before, and practices start to make sense in a way that they couldn't before. And whole sections of the Atharva Veda, for instance, and the Yoga Upanishads, and whole sections of the Upanishads. I was just reading the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Chandogya, which have a lot about the nature of food and how it transforms into the natural world and transforms into the body, links to breath, creates life, and is Brahman. All that stuff seems a bit senseless until you have some of the foundations that people like particularly David Gordon White have provided. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in ritual, not only as important in life, but also as something that reveals assumptions about the Hindu worldview, or assumptions within the Hindu worldview. So one might say that while there are sacred texts of Hindu literature, hymns and poetry, philosophy and theology, ethics and customs, stories, histories, all of these texts are paralleled by a particularly rich enacted text of different genres and forms of ritual. And I'm interested to try and analyze, just as you might analyze different genres of text and different discourses within text. So just as a devotional text, a Purana, may augment their glorification of the deity with cosmological discourses within it, describing the origins of the universe, and narrative discourses describing stories of the gods, and metaphysical treatises suddenly will turn up in their completely different discourse and genre. And ritual instructions will suddenly enter in, like all these different things. So I think that we need to start seeing practices in that way. There are different discourses that have different goals and assumptions, and that the larger text of a particular ritual or practice will combine, they'll draw upon. So what kind of discourses can we find? Well, in the particular context I was looking at, I was struck mostly by these three forms, and I'm sure there are others, and I think it is true that these three forms get mixed together. But I've put them at the top of the handout there. One, structuring practices. So structuring practices are ones that give orders to our lives or our society, or restructuring practices, which alternatively break down those structures so that they can be reconfigured in new ways. And as we'll see, I think I'm thinking of these in a way that's almost the paradigmatic structuring practice is the Vedic ritual for which a reaffirmation of vritta or dharma is the important thing. Life stage rituals, where why are you doing a life stage ritual? To reinforce the fact that you've moved on to a new stage of your life, right? So it's both marking the point of structural change, marking a certain order. I've got another copy here. Or it's marking, it's not only marking a certain order, but it's actually reinforcing it. Right? So the woman is pregnant, or the child has been born, or the boy has become a man. We know that structural change has happened. We see this order in action, but we need to reinstantiate this order. And that much is written on this kind of thing, and I'll come back to it. The second one is transformative practices, which transform. I nearly called this divinizing, but not all such practices divinize. So more broadly, transformative practice, which transforms some aspect of the world around us so that it opens up to become a medium for divine presence. I have to alter that, actually. So it opens up to another form of reality. And I'll say more about that as well in a second. But the idea partly here is that transformative practice is really important in any culture, any worldview that sees reality, material reality, objects, things, existing phenomena, as having more than one mode of existence, Right, and we're very bad at getting that in the modern West because we've got this weird idea called matter. And we assume that matter is the only mode of existence. But of course, most cultures didn't feel that way. And they saw that there were clearly other modes of existence. The West spends a lot of time thinking about this in relation to the Trinity and things like this, and forgets that it once had ether as one mode of existence. So it's really interesting in modal thought, basically. And India, of course, is super interested in this. We have all these metaphors of milk transforming into curd, etc. The notion that substances have multiple modes in which they can exist. And that's come out hugely in the work of, again, David Gordon White, also people like Dominic Wujastik, everyone working on the ethereal body, yogic body, prana bodies, the other bodies within the self. And the alchemical connection reminds us that there are other bodies, other forms of body, if you like, within objects. And of course, if you do Vedanta, particularly after Pancharatra, you see that in relation to the divine as well, the divine is also seen as something that has not one form of existence, one mode, but multiple modes of existence. Right? That's not true for everyone. It's probably not true for strict Advaitins, but it's true in many schools, and they're all thinking about that. So that's the transformative practices I'll come back to. And the third one was interactive practices. And here, paradigmatically, I'm thinking, if the first one is Vedic, the second one, my paradigm for thinking about it is Tantric. The third one, my paradigm for thinking about it is, of course, Murtis, Puja, Darshan, Murti Seva, so the devotional and bhakti practices. Interactive practices that allow us to build a relationship with divine beings, revered figures, or a sacred reality in such a way that it becomes part of the everyday life of the community. In some ways, that links with what I said about deities and the divine having a certain kind of personal relationship, almost communal relationship with us. I think it has something to do with the animist history of a lot of Hindu thought. And the idea that we assume that we ought to be able to live with the divine and that there's an interaction. And when I say divine beings there, I think I don't just mean deities. I think that's on a continuous axis with things like gurus, who are often seen as being in some sense divine, but you live with them, around them, and your interaction is essential. Saints, if you like, acharyas, and other figures. And of course, just at an everyday level, spirits or small local deities who you really are local. They're in space. They're in your space and time. In terms of the stories, they're really living with you. And I'll come back to examples of that. So I'll just go through a couple of examples and you can tell me whether you think I'm crazy, which is probably true. So the structuring practices, I mean, with that, there's a huge amount here on Vedic material. And of course, the whole analysis of the notions of Ritta and Dharma as both, let's say, as both descriptive and prescriptive, as both, if you like, metaphysical and normative. It is the case that there are four varnas, and we have to make it the case that there are four varnas. Or it is the case that the sun rises every day, but we have to make it the case. Ritta is the case. There is this structure in the universe, and yet we have to bend into it, right? So it's different from a simple metaphysical structure where it simply is there, and that's regardless of what we do. It's a different kind of thing. It's interesting to see how that, to compare that with other forms of structure in other cultures, where often it's either just there. I think the West doesn't have a form of structure that depends on us for our cooperation, partly because God's up there reinforcing it. Science too isn't really interested in us being involved in reaffirming the structure. The whole point of laws of nature is that they precede us. Taoism, for instance, I think is really, it's always useful to not only compare India to Europe, but maybe to compare it to, for instance, China, where in Taoism you have a different sense of structure. There is an order, there is a flow, but we are part of it, just as every small current is part of the river and can ultimately affect the river. So there's a kind of a sense there that maybe it's not wholly descriptive of the order or prescriptive of us making the order, but again, there's an assumption that humans play not a determining part, but a contributive part. And that comes up in all kinds of work. I could easily put a quote from... I've said I've put these quotes in here partly because I want the text that I end up with out of this project to have both an analysis of the different paradigms and what scholars have said about it, but also examples from textual contexts, both secondary literature of the scholars and primary literature. And one could look at the order there, all that stuff about Vishnu and his three wide strides and the cosmogonic material. And, of course, Fritz Stahl and his emphasis on grammar. But there's a nice one from William Mahoney here, who I think he wrote The Artful Universe, where his focus in that book is on Vedic ritual as a way that we are artists helping to create the universe. All the stories about the gods creating the universe is meant to be a model for us to follow. Right? It's not just a story of the past, it's for us to do. William Mahoney describes the Hindu emphasis on structure, originating in the Vedic period, but continuing through the various Hindu traditions that drew on Vedic texts and customs, as deriving from a worldview that sees the cosmos as linked by an underlying harmonious structure to which all things are connected. He writes, Vedic religion in general revolved around the ideas that the wondrous marvels and powers of nature, the diverse personalities and behavior of the many gods and goddesses who gave form to and enlivened the world, the composition and dynamics of the human community and the structure and destiny of the individual person are all somehow linked to one another through a transcendent universal order and harmony of being. That the power of this hidden principle could be harnessed and expressed in effective language. That because of the interconnectedness of all beings, actions performed in any one of such realms therefore affect the status of others. And that's a nice pithy bit that gives you some sense of the underpinnings, the worldview that is necessary for ordering rituals to function at all. I.e., all of that is somehow implied in all such rituals. And one can go on and just look at that. The Vedic ritual examples kind of bring that out, I think. I won't read all of the next one, but it's interesting to look at specific cases. One of the most famous hymns, of course, is the cosmogonic description of the creation of the natural world through the gods' ritual sacrifice of a first-person Purusha. So this is the Purusha Sukta. And it's just interesting to see here how every action of the sacrifice, of course, is, I mean, this is all well established, but links to the broader macrocosmos of the universe. So Purusha himself is linked to the world. He has 1,000 heads, eyes, feet, pervades the earth everywhere and extends beyond. He is all of this, whatever has been and whatever is to be. And when the gods spread the sacrifice using Purusha as the offering, spring was the butter, summer the fuel, autumn the oblation. With him they sacrificed, and from that sacrifice in which everything was offered, the clarified butter was obtained, and they made it into beasts who live in the air, forest, villages, etc. So this is really just for people to see how immediately these multiple worlds of sacrifice and universe and ritual action, etc., and indeed the body, are linked. And you see this in the Shrauta Sutras in interesting ways. So the Shrauta Sutras record in detail the actions undertaken by figures such as the Advaryu in a specific order and according to strict instructions that are meant to constitute Vedic rituals, such as the Agnishtoma sacrifice. I really wanted with this just to find one of the texts that really gives the specific Vedic actions. People don't tend to read those texts. People go to the Rig Veda Samhita, which is all hymns. People don't tend to go to the Shrauta Sutras, where you actually get the ritual instructions, and see how extraordinarily precise they are. Performing the rite of spreading the grass, placing the utensils in the proper order, sprinkling with strainers, taking out the butter and putting it on the fire, proceeding with means of the wooden sword, calling... give the call for the placing, etc., etc. So it's all very, very concise. And that sense of order, I think, comes out strongly there. I sometimes think that surely the Vedic ritual is the most complex and concisely prescriptive ritual possibly in the world. I mean, there aren't many other cultures that can have quite such detailed rituals, partly because not only are there specific actions and times for it, but there are also specific persons of many, many different kinds of priest, locations, mathematical spatial designations, and also, of course, linguistic designations, right? And we get the whole of Sanskrit linguistics coming out of this because of this fascination with order and concision. So I'm kind of interested in how that works, this syntactic conception of ritual. as an expression of a structuring feature, right? And the whole of language comes after that. So Sanskrit in the order of language, it's interesting to see how the ties between the ritual order created by humans and the order of the universe went beyond nature to the transcendent reality believed to lie beyond it, which is accessed through language by the rishis. And with that, we get the development of vyakarana and grammatical understandings of order, which is interesting as well, I think, because it adds to ritual the sense that if you do, to bring a linguistic grammar to the notion of order is to show why order matters. If you can say, you can do a ritual and say, well, you have to do this action before this action, and people will say, well, why? Those actions aren't clearly in any kind of order of preference or precedence. But with language, you can see it more easily, that a sentence just doesn't seem to make sense if you do it in a certain way. I mean, that's arguably all right. Of course, different languages do mess around with it. But at least you can then see that what's happening in a language is, once you've learned the rules, that's how it makes sense. That's how you build its meaning in your mind. I'm interested in the way in which language comes to provide a way of analysing action and the meaningfulness of action. And I have to think about that more, I think. And social order, I think, also then provides a complement, rather than a meaning or hermeneutic-based analysis of why order matters. Social order provides a kind of complementarian analysis of why order matters. The justification for social orders, which we also have to follow through, is based on the idea that there is going to be symbiosis, that interdependent parts work best in a certain way. So don't get the rich guys to till the fields, don't get the poor guys without enough food, who can't ever eat meat and get strong, to go and fight the wars. Let's see how things fit by their own natural law. In a way, there's a natural law philosophy implicit in any philosophy of order. Let's see how that works and make sure that things are functioning in a complementary way that reflects their natural capacities and dispositions. And here we've got a quote from just Barbara Holdridge, who describes Dharma as a concept that shapes certain fundamental cosmic, semantic, social, and ethical structures of the Hindu worldview. Dharma structures the universe as a vast cosmic ecosystem, an intricate network of symbiotic relations among interdependent parts, in which each part has a specific function to perform that contributes to the whole system. Dharma establishes each part in its proper place and ensures that every aspect of the cosmic system is properly balanced and coordinated with every other aspect. At each level, an organic unity is structured in which the separation of functions among the various classes of beings is clearly defined, specific functions or modes of activity being assigned to each class of beings in accordance with its inherent nature. In its normative dimension, Dharma, the cosmic ordering principle, finds expression on the human plane in the ritual, social, and moral orders, particularly as represented in the Brahmanical system of socio-cultural norms. And so you see that even not only in the Varnas, you also see it in the Ashrama system, that there are just, that for life to fulfill its nature and to complete its teleology, it has to have different periods, each of which performs a function that is complementary to the others. And in a way, you could read this as an advance on a kind of an Aristotelian teleology. The acorn has to become the oak tree. That's its nature, and that's its proper order, which it has to fulfill. But here we've got a kind of perhaps a notion of complementarity enters into that notion of natural order, so that you not only fulfill your nature, but that a range of different natures should be complementary to the fulfillment of the whole ultimate teleology, and that even within your nature, let's say the human nature is to support Dharma and to move beyond Dharma to achieve some realization of truth, you're going to have component parts within that, so that complementarity could be seen to enter into a kind of a natural law philosophy there. I'm just interested in how that looks. I just went to a paper on the anthropology of ethics, how to study ethics in other cultures. And the theorists had done a really good job of trying to think about this, but their whole conception of ethics was based on a Western conception of ethics. And so what would it look like if we brought Hindu conceptions in there? Just thinking about that. So there's all those examples, and we can look at, you know, social order, language order, Vedic ritual order, life stage rituals and festivals. And I think also one might bring into that the notion that What does, reading the Yoga Sutras, what do the Yoga Sutras do? What kind of practice are they? I think they're more than one, but they make me see how much Hinduism is interested in bringing order to all kinds of areas of disorder. And one of those is the mind. People always see ritual and practice as bodily. But of course, in Hinduism, there's a particularly strong emphasis on ritual and practice that is mental. And one might say that prayer is another internal practice. But in the Hindu context, the emphasis is on ordering. So the Yoga Sutra is really interested in bringing a certain order or structure to the mind and sees the mind as disordered. And I think that comes out in Samkhya as well, that there's a kind of a structure to the mind that we should have control of and put back into its better order. And actually, you see that as well in later bhakti aesthetic literatures, where, again, you're trying to order the mind. The emotions are disordered. They spring up randomly. You can't build upon them to higher states. But if you read devotional texts on rasa, for instance, one of the things it's trying to do is yoga-like. It's trying to teach you how to get control of this disordered field and restructure it into what actually it should be, a more ordered and a more beneficial structure. So that there we'd also be wanting to say that it's important to see that practices are not always bodily, they're also mental, and that rituals are not always bodily, they're also mental, and that the ordering function is often an inner function as well as an external one. Okay, so that's thinking about the structuring practices. The second paradigm would just be transformative practices, and this is kind of where all that tantric stuff comes in. And for this, I think already there's a need to start talking about metaphysics. I think what's happened is that we've realized we can't understand whether it's the initiation of students into an order, whether it's the initiation and awakening of a Murti image, a statue of the deity, whether it's the transformation of a tantric initiate into a divine body or into Shiva or into some other being. Or whether it's just a village practice of possession by which somebody's inviting the deity to enter into them and transform them. In all of these cases, you can't understand it without a sense of this material metaphysical background as being many-leveled, a kind of multivocal materiality. And I think that takes us back to the interest in elements and energies in the natural world that we see going back all the way to quite early texts. So the Upanishads refer repeatedly to the generation and transformation of elements and natural substances into the world that we know. Food is given pride of place as a basic component of the natural world, a kind of energy from which other elements emerge. But you also get that with prana, you also get it with sunlight, actually. And some other things. And in each of these, we have a notion of a substrate that can go through different modes and be transformed. And I think that links to the philosophical fascination, or in the beginning, kind of proto-philosophical fascination with the concept of parinama, transformation. Parinama going through a range of different names, something that is able to transform. So already, like if you study Beda schools, early developments of Vedanta, they're thinking about how things transform. They're not thinking about God just as a fixed reality. There's always a question about the nature of mutability that's in there already. And from very early periods, the image of clay being shaped into different things is paralleled with the image of milk or substances that just have different modes as capable, that are kind of capacities for them. So interested in all of this, and that comes out later in the yogic Upanishads with notions of the other bodies within the self, and it comes out, of course, in the alchemical literatures as well. People always forget that if you read Madhava Sarvadarshana Sangraha, which, of course, is a much later medieval text, when he lists all these 16 schools of thought, along with the Shaivas, the Advaitins, the Bedabedins, etc., the Rasa, the Rasayana school, the alchemists are in there as well. And somehow their understanding of these multi-leveled substances is a really important part of that cultural world. So I haven't got a text yet for that one. There's a lot in the Atharva Veda, a lot in the Yoga Upanishads, a lot in the Upanishads that talk about these transformations. They often refer to breath, sunlight, and other substances as the raw material of nature, and later they become identified with Brahman, something universal that takes on new forms. It definitely comes out in rituals. Again, the rituals we don't always pay attention to. Spells, substances, purification. If you look at the Atharva Veda, it's just this huge list of spells. And the actual instructions for them are really fascinating. And they relate to a lot of the smaller rituals that are done in villages all across India and throughout Hindu culture, ones that often kind of fly under the radar. The Atharvaveda Samhita records an enormous number of spells used for healing, blessing, curse, and invocation of the aid of certain deities or natural forces. Verses appealing to water for its blessing are particularly common. And I've just put here one about water, but it's amazing how many of these are basically invocations and kind of glorifications of a substance and its ability not only to change, but to change other things. So this kind of transformative ideology is under there. And that links, David Gordon White makes that very clear, that links to the development of a yogic idea that you can change the mind and the body through a series of different substance transformations as well. So that just as mercury has different states, so too does the body, so too does the mind. And on the next page, there's a quote from the Malini Vijayottara Tantra, which reflects kind of yogic views of the self. And that's really just there to show how much the physical self is a multi-leveled, multifaceted self. That indestructible Lord who stands at the edge of 12 stages or components, as our teacher who remains divorced from all desires, fetters, and defilements, who in you, as in me, in the earth and the sky, exists as one bursting with radiance, shooting from the basal center at the bottom of the spine, coursing through the inner channels, the nadis, passing up through the six centers, reaching the cranial lotus, crashing through that rapturous fissure, by that nectar which comes from the disk of the moon. So again, already this notion of consciousness and these energies is something which has a cosmological correlate, a macrocosmic correlate, comes drops, bindu, which reach the basal center. And when is there such bliss? All of that kind of yogic stuff is becoming much more prominent. People are much more aware of it, but we're still trying to find, I think, ways in which to understand it in connection with our understanding of Hinduism, Hindu culture more generally. And of course, all the work on mantras has also brought that out. So Andre Padu's book really shows mantras as the point of connection between subtle materiality and gross materiality. Mantras, because they are both tangible and yet they don't have a physical form, sound is what we're saying, is both tangible and has no physical form, seem to exemplify the notion of a many-leveled reality. And therefore, it's partly because of this twofold nature, as he puts it, that they are able to be effective in ritual, in transformative ritual. Right. So the last line of the top quote there, he says, this, one could say, contradictory nature of tantric mantras appears clearly in many of their ritual, meditative, mystical, or magical uses. And they have power. They're supposed to be directly effective. They do what they say. They purify, protect, cut, transform. Water into Amrita, for instance, or the body of the performer into a divine one, or into one made of mantras, that should be, bringing about the presence of a deity in an icon or on a mandala. Right. So again, we have this sense that these is a whole genre of ritual that's focused on the notion of being able to shift between different levels of the existence of a thing. And that's not only different kinds of matter, which is the way the West sees it, because it's such a dualistic tradition on the whole, but it's between levels of divinity and undivinity, levels of supernatural power and not supernatural power, etc. Well, I won't go through the details of the next example, but divine descent and temple worship. Obviously, people are realizing that all of this is essential for understanding contemporary temple worship. And so I've got an example there from a tantric temple tradition. The Shaiva Agamas, where the priest must transform his hand into the hand of Shiva in order to do an action that relates to Shiva. So he has to put part of himself into a different state. And here again, how the ritual does this. And in the Puranas, where again we see the instructions for installing an actual murti or a temple image are very much premised on this notion of creating a new reality in the temples. This is the Shiva Purana example I've given in the box there. And again, the Omkara mantra helps to do this, sprinkling the different materials of worship, certain roots, certain sandal paste, substances, etc. So substances and words all are seen as things that are already across mode. If that's the transformative paradigm, then the last one would be interacting practices. And I think this is important perhaps because what does Murti Seva do if you're interacting with the deity? If you're praying to the deity in darshana, Are you transforming yourself? Yes, that's one of the things you're doing, but I think it would be wrong to say that the main goal of Murti Seva is that you're trying to change yourself. I mean, this is where someone like David Haberman's book on Bhakti Raganuga Sadhana, where Bhakti transforms you into a different being, a higher spiritual being, is important. Transformative practices have their place in Bhakti. And I've argued elsewhere that Bhakti literatures, their emotional register, they're so melodramatic because they're trying to transform you emotionally, affectively, internally. So I think there's a huge element of that transformative material going on, both in temple practice and in the kind of emotional experiential side of Bhakti. But that can't be all. Interacting practices, it seems to me, are also happening on their own basis. You're interacting with the deity because the relationship with the deity is really important. And it's also, again, not ordering. It's often disordering. So obviously spirit and deity offerings, but I think I want to make that connection with spirit offerings. To me, Murti Puja really makes sense when you spend time around Asia more generally and see how widespread it is that people are constantly interacting on a daily basis with beings who are in their houses. They're bringing them breakfast, they're saying goodnight, they are having really quite a normal community-oriented interaction with them. So it's a relationship. Relationship is absolutely crucial. Embodied relationship, you could call it. And that kind of brings into focus what's happening when you go into the temple, and this is just a larger version of that shrine in some respects, right? So the temple garbha is the spirit shrine that you see in many contexts. And that it's not just that people are living alongside them in this kind of neighborhood way, but that there's the meeting and serving of the deities, of course. And I put in a quote from Richard Davis, who wrote a very good book, The Lives of Images, I think. Maybe it's The Lives of Indian Images. Where he contrasts the statues in a gallery with how they would have been encountered in an actual temple, and how much this is a personal interaction. And the last example I've given of that is Patricia Dold, who writes about the ritual's possession of the temple of the goddess Kamakhya, where the goddesses take on the human forms of the deodars, and she gives a very compelling description of how people are interacting with those deodars, talking to them, relating to them, moving spatially with them, being embraced by them, speaking to them, having a very important kind of personal relationship with them. And he goes on and she goes on and analyzes that. So I think that's mainly what I want to do, is just put forward those three different paradigms that we have, the structuring practice, we have the transformative practice, and we have the interacting practice. And I'm sure there are others, but it seems to me those are three particularly characteristic and important ones, where there's a whole paradigm behind them that one has to understand to see what people are doing. There's a whole worldview. And yet, together, they kind of help to account for quite a lot of what's going on in the distinctive different genres of Hindu ritual and practice. I think that's all. Okay. Yeah. I realize, having done all of that, in some ways it's totally weird. Why would anybody try and come up with to summarize the whole of Hindu practice in three themes? It's obviously a bit reductive. But I also think, I don't know, what do you think? Is it helpful to have these assumptions brought out in some way? Because I think they're not brought out at the moment.
Well, it helps to structure these things, I think. In the sense of, otherwise you just have a whole array of things that you can't quite... I think it's been helpful, definitely. I was thinking, in terms of a fourth, I mean, I don't know much about the Advaitic tradition, but
yeah,
the kinds of practices that they wouldn't seem to really... I don't know,
where would they fall here?
In the sense that these, in some sense, seem to presuppose a sort of a realistic view of the universe, one who's trying to radically sort of alter oneself, in a sense. Would that be a fourth category, do you think?
I think it's a good question. In some ways, I was like, okay, well, what are the... In a way, we're talking then about yogic practices, kind of, or meditative practices, or self... deconstructing practices, that the kind of thing you mean?
Yeah, self-deconstruct, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and that's part... I mean, there are two things there. I think in some ways part of me still wants to say that's transformative, right? So there are all these... Is it true Christians, Muslims, Jews don't spend so much time trying to transform themselves? They don't see themselves as malleable objects, or and by objects I include the mind, you do your best with it, or you have free will and you use it in certain ways, and the right and wrong forms of use are the thing that matter. Whereas in Hinduism, there's still this sense of shaping and the notion and the ways of reshaping. Mm. But that also goes to me into the mixing between the different categories. How are they reshaping? Well, there's a lot of structuring. It's a bit silly because the structuring and the transformative are the same. It's an issue of structuring yourself in a certain way. But destructuring. Mm. Actually, initially, there was a structuring and destructuring.
I mean, if there's also a kind of total negation in a sense. So there's a kind of difference. I mean, not that I know much about these traditions, but in terms of tantric practices,
mm-hmm.
where you are, in a sense, transforming yourself, sort of moving up different levels of the cosmology, and an actual kind of a leap to
a radical non.
To the study of Vedanta or the meditation on the Mahavakyas, for instance.
That's right, and I wonder how that, I mean, in some ways that's interesting. It invites analysis of exactly what those practices involve.
Mm.
So if I think, for instance, of yoga in the classical Samkhya yoga notion, that you're trying to break down the different thought activities, the different structures of thought, so that you eventually get rid of them one by one, and you end up with only, perhaps you get rid of sensation, get rid of action, end up with mind, get rid of mind, thought, cognitive thought, come back to ahamkara, ego, and eventually get rid of ego. You're kind of systematically destructuring. You're taking that structure and actively breaking it down. You're right, it's a bit different and I wonder if that's the majority of practices, that they're systematically getting rid of the structures. You're right, it's a bit different if there's a sudden leap.
Exactly, yeah.
But what would be examples of that? Who do that as their practice?
I don't know, the Dashnami orders?
Maybe.
So I don't know much about those practices, but I've always assumed that they exist.
I'm curious about it, actually. Like, clearly that exists in the Buddhist context.
Mm.
Where you've got things like, you've got the debate between gradual enlightenment and sudden enlightenment.
Yeah.
You've got like Satori versus blah, blah, blah. So you've got the sudden aha moment.
Mm.
But I wonder how much, I mean, obviously it's there. It doesn't work to say it's not there, but I wonder if that's relatively rare in the Hindu tradition, that Hinduism is almost always building something.
Sure.
And of course that debate exists in bhakti as well. Is it that... that was an article by June McDaniel. Is bhakti something you achieve by going, love?
Mm-hmm.
Or, in fact, are you actually supposed to build it? Right?
Yeah.
And is that the whole point of practice and sadhana and the analysis of rasa?
And then something like the Sri Vaishnava tradition is prapatti and sharanagati, right? So more progressive, normative kind of
bhakti. That's right. You've got practices that are meant to invite, in that case, grace. That's kind of the function of grace.
Yeah.
I mean, how if you wanted to explain, let's say, a prapatti inviting, like the ritual, the practice where you invite grace from the deity, and that grace suddenly makes you able to completely transform your understanding, and you're now a new person in some sense.
Mm.
How would one explain that? What is going on there? Is there, like, conceptually, how do they think that works? I guess is partly what I'm asking.
Mm.
How are people saying, okay, so what is it that grace, what kind of thing is grace doing there? Why does their ritual of doing it work?
Revelatory or something, in some sense. It's I don't know.
Well,
from within, how does the tradition itself understand?
Exactly. What's kind of the ideological background behind this?
I guess a lot of these are kind of the practitioner themselves are kind of moving upwards, whereas there's more of a descent, to kind of rupture in the order of things.
Yeah, I'm curious about it. I mean, in some ways, so there's the gradual movement where you make yourself into the other thing. And I think grace is a good example, because a lot of people will look at the grace theologies and say, well, that's just Hinduism being silly. That's when it stops being rational, right? And that's when it gets theological, but it's no longer thinking itself out very clearly. And I think that's a good example of where it needs a bit more understanding of what's how we understand grace working. Mm. So, for instance, grace doesn't work unless you become the right person. But I think that's because, you know, maybe grace is a funny moment where the transformative way of looking at things, you need to become someone else, shifted and met the interactive. Mm. So it's your interaction with this person that's going to give you not what you need, that sounds very bad, but it's the interaction that matters. So you're then going to the deity and not just saying, please help me, please have a good relationship with me. You're going to the deity and saying, please change me. But change me without the normal actions. Change me through a special power you have. I mean, potentially it makes sense if you think of, for instance, Krishna or Vishnu as yoga, Yogishwara, the God who has power, the God who is a guru, the God who can initiate you. The connection between the God giving you grace and the guru who changes who you are, if you see what I mean, and the notion that it's Shiva's hand that, you know, brings you into the fold, as it were.
But like in the prayers of the Alwars, is the notion I'm helpless, really, in a sense, mm-hmm. to do anything now. I just come before you and I pray that you accept me as yours.
Which I think, is really, I mean, there is that kind of passive kenosis. There's also that thing of like letting yourself be taken over by this other force. But it'd be interesting. That is, again, and just to say briefly that's another kind of practice in Hinduism that is not well understood and I think needs more understanding. What are people doing in those? If bhakti is not just a mode of relating and a literature, but a practice of turning yourself into something that is altered and that it's completely open, that is able to be, I mean, some people analyze it, Fred Smith analyzes it as a form of possession. Mm. You can only understand bhakti if you understand the idea of opening up the gates and letting the divine take you and transform you into something else. Mm. Then it's part of a kind of it's an extension of the transformative. It's the relationship of love mixed with the notion of changing yourself into a different being and divinizing yourself. And actually that kind of analysis from Fred Smith made me understand rasa literature or emotional bhakti much more clearly.
Is that in his book on possession?
self-possessed, but he kind of looks at certain cases, bhakti cases, and looks at all the, you see this a lot, so karma is a god who comes into you. It's not an emotional state you acquire, it's something that goes into you and changes you into a different being, just as someone who's possessed is entered and altered. Just as the yogic master is able to transform the deity, the disciple, by going into him and altering him. Mm. So there's this notion of transforming, but not just by your own natural process of alchemy, but by having someone come in and do it for you, if you see what I mean. Mm. And maybe that's one of the things that's feeding into the concept of grace, which, I mean, the very definition of it is grace is kind of weird, because that's the most Christian idea you could think of, right? And I think there isn't even a concept of grace in Judaism and Islam very clearly. Not that same kind of thing. Whereas Christianity has a concept of grace that's partly to do with the idea that we're sinful and we need to be purified, right? So what a weird concept to map onto the Hindu case, where what is grace really doing, I guess? So it invites those questions in some ways.
Sorry, unless anyone else has got a question.
Please.
It's a kind of response to Fritz Stahl's notion of rules without meaning, would you say?
I think so, yeah.
And how would he respond to this? Because I've never fully understood what he's... I can't quite conceive of what he's trying to say. That would this be simply retrojection, sort of back onto ultimately something that doesn't really have meaning embedded in it?
Well, it's a good question. The first ever issue of the Journal of Hindu Studies we did on hermeneutics, and we invited him to write for it, and he wrote something on the misconception that we should be trying to interpret these things. But he also brought out in his article, I think, that he sees hermeneutics, he sees the finding of meaning as something very propositional, literal. So dog, picture of dog, pot, picture of dog, go, picture of walking. There's a kind of one-to-one correspondence between a word and meaning, or it's symbolic. And I kind of said in my response to his article in that first issue, he's shown us that we can't look for obvious meanings in the old way that we're used to from certain kinds of text, but that we have to look more widely for other kinds of meaning, right? Embodied meaning, enacting meaning, meanings that are to do with the way it makes you feel, meanings that are to do with creating community or reinforcing tradition or giving a sense of order, or all these different things. And he wrote back in a private email to me. That was interesting. He said, I'm not sure I agree with everything, but you have made me think that I need to understand that hermeneutics isn't just the search for a specific kind of meaning. It's, and that actually there's a range of other ways something can signify. You know, so that when you, you know, if you kiss someone you love, you're not symbolically saying something necessarily. I think it would be right to, you know, you say, oh yes, a kiss means I love you. But it doesn't, if you want to say I love you, say I love you. It does a range of things. It lets some people, lets the person see that, but it also is an expression. It also reinforces a relationship. It also is a way of expressing an emotion that's part of your affectivity of your relationship. Like, there's so many other things going on that show us the meaning. And it does reveal a worldview about the nature of human relations and what's involved subjectively in people's being with another person, right? So all of that stuff is there. And I think that maybe Fritz would say, okay, so if meaning is something much bigger, then they're not rules without meaning.
That's interesting. So expanding our conception of meaning. Or
in a way, meaning, yeah. And we've been doing that a lot in Hindu studies lately anyway. I better stop because I'm a student, but thank you guys for listening anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Any points that are useful?
Is it next week, is it week 7, the next one, or is it week 8? On the ICHS website, it's next week.
Oh, really? That's interesting. So. Oh, maybe it's... Oh, I hope it's not next week, because actually I'm not here next week. I'll be in Washington. I'll ask them to change that. It's quite helpful, thank you. Cool. Yeah, in some ways I'm like, why am I coming up with these simplifications? But on the other hand, I kind of feel like in other religions, in the study of other religions and areas of culture, people do have paradigms that they use to interpret. And you don't assume that it's exactly right, but it's a conceptual paradigm that's just helpful.
It's good to explain.
Yeah, and having...
It's good if you perhaps want to go out of just comparing
and
perhaps seeing it, only studying Hinduism.
Yeah.
Not with the help from...
Not with these other, yeah, exactly.
I think that would be very useful.
And like, sometimes I do think it would be helpful, like, so many Hindus are trying to explain the image, and they can't explain the image, because they can't explain how it's God but not God. They can't explain how it's a physical manifestation of God but not the only one, and how there can be more than one, like that ontology that people just don't even get it, and they look at them like, you're crazy, and Hindus don't themselves have the language with which to explain it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of true as well, maybe, with, you know, even yoga, with Bhakti and Murti say, well, why are you treating that funny little doll like a person? What are you doing? You know, well, this is part of a whole interactive. Why would you want to bathe your God? Well, actually, that forms links with a certain way of interacting with the divine and a certain understanding of personalism and the psychology of your relationship. And, you know, all that stuff is implicit and isn't easily said. Anyway, okay. Thank you guys for listening, because it is actually helpful for me to kind of think my way through these things along the way.
And like, from all these things, we're going to be able to get sort of like definitions, kind of more precise definitions of terms like Vedic and Tantric and Bhakti, in a sense, right, from the various themes that we've been touching on.
Yeah, that's helpful, actually, you're right. Yeah. Everyone's upset, because if you say Tantric... There's an article by Haranaga Isaacson and Dominic Goodall where they say, so everyone's talking about tantric now, but they're also all talking about it as if it means one thing. So David Gordon White is like, this is very tantric, because it has possession.
Yeah.
But tons of tantra has no possession. Someone else says, this is very tantric, it's using mantras, but not all tantra uses mantras. So you're right, this kind of, again, we all need to get a bit more exact about these things.
You have to invent a new language.
Yeah.
That people... We'll understand.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which is kind of impossible.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
They will already understand.
That they will already understand.
Hear.
Yeah, and I think some of that is about bringing concepts into common parlance. People get karma. They don't get it exactly correctly, but they kind of get the concept now of a kind of reciprocal ethics.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really get Dharma, but they're closer, you know, and even yoga as a concept, before we had that idea in the West, people be like, you're doing what? What does meditating even mean? How is that supposed to work?
Yeah.
You bring the idea in, and then it starts to make possible other ways of talking about certain things. So.
But also about, ways that aren't in India.
Yeah, so yes, exactly.
It's confusing as well as making points.
Yeah, you're right, I think you're right about that.